Here we are today with Martin Gott from Holker Farm, and the reason we brought you along is because I think that your farm is really cool. I love Sauvignon cheese. I think it's a cheese that kind of ticked all my boxes in terms of what I'm looking for, from, you know, made on the farm, small scale, sustainable agriculture, natural cheese making methods. It's got bags of flavour. And I think you should be proud of that, because I think that's your cheese is amazing. The thing I also like about your cheese is it pushes people's boundaries, whereas it's not like, oh, that's nice. It's actually like, you might not like this cheese. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I think it's a good thing that, you know, I don't think every cheese should be liked. And, you know, I think that that's what increases, and it's a lot of people nowadays make, when they're going to making cheese, make a nice recipe that's a very nice cheese. And as I remember Joe Schneider saying, the worst compliment you could ever get is, oh, your cheese is nice.
I remember reading something about Budweiser before I started making cheese, and it said it's the most approachable, or the least offensive beer in the world.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a sad statement. You know, it's a beer that everybody wants to drink because it doesn't taste anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't really offend anyone. It doesn't challenge anyone. You just drink it. And I thought that's it's at the opposite end of what we do.
Yes.
Yeah. We want to create something that inspires people and that people just taste. And fine, that's not for everyone, but, you know, we don't make enough. Yeah. The world, so
no,
it's not my concern.
Yeah,
I like it, and I like it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's amazing. When it's good, I would have it on my cheese board every week, and it is variable as well. And I think it's when it's good, it's hard to beat. But I always say that maybe when I taste that to people, 40-50% of people won't like it, but the other 50% who do will probably drive halfway across the country to get it, which I think is a good sign. You know, so it's.
Even in our family, it's divisive. You know, like I like cheese a certain way. Nicola likes the St. James when it's different.
Yeah.
And Daniel, my little lad, likes it when it's different again. And you think, yeah, between the same family eating the cheese, you know, there's three different opinions of when it's good and what it should taste like. And you go, well, that's that sort of changeability or that seasonality. Yeah. That's, you know, that's interesting as well for me. That making something that's not always the same, but allowing for that natural variation in the milk and the seasons, and the, you know, a little bit of that is the way we're doing it by hand and using these natural cultures.
That's one of the things that really interests me about your farm, is you are trying to do something that is interesting, different in the UK, but something, you know, we were talking about earlier on, pre-1880, every single farm was doing it. Whereas now in the UK, I think you are using your own natural starter cultures. I think, I don't know whether anybody else is. Finsbury did a little bit.
Last count, I think there was four of us in the UK that were using natural cultures.
Yeah.
So that was the guys at Innes who were using whey starters. Bill at Capercasey's using a whey starter.
Yeah.
And Mary uses a little bit of whey starter. So that's three, and then there's us. Yeah, so that's four.
Yeah.
So that was the last time I looked. That was it, you know. And then I compared it to like Parmigiano Reggiano, where there's 3,000 producers, and they all use whey starters.
Yeah.
I was like, so it's not something that it's unique in the UK because of the way things are in the UK.
Yeah.
Because of our regulation, because of our history, because of the industry in the UK. But it's not unique across the world to do what we do.
No.
There's plenty of examples where they're doing this sort of thing. But I think so that for me was like a bit of a license to go forward and say, this isn't groundbreaking stuff. It is in the UK.
Yeah.
But it's not groundbreaking the world. We're not reinventing the wheel or trying to do something that's out there. You know, it's not that somebody wants to call me fringe. You know, I'm a fringe producer doing something that's outside of what everybody else does. It's not actually. It's what lots of people are doing.
Yeah.
But it's just not so popular.
It's what every
so
well known over here.
Yeah.
You know, it's what every content producer is doing. Yeah.
And these are cheeses that everybody have in the fridge. They're for sale in the co-op. You know, the cheeses, they're not, these aren't niche fringe cheeses. They're cheeses that everybody knows, that people associate with, you know, being a true product or product of a certain country or a certain region. And we take it for granted that these cheeses are just, they're safe, they're on the shelf, they're available. They're even actually, some of them, you know, they're borderline sort of commodity products, you know.
Yeah.
And yet they're made with these home-produced, farm-based indigenous cultures.
So just for people, because I always...
Five people that are watching this.
But I always say...
There's three and two more.
Yeah.
And he's one of
starter culture, you need starter culture, and you need to acidify the milk to make cheese, and that's key part of cheese making. And that then most people in the UK will use a thing called starter cultures, and what that does is a little packet of bacteria. I always compare it to making bread, and I think that... And most people use this thing called direct-to-vat, which is a little packet of bacteria. You sprinkle it in your milk, it starts acidifying the milk, it starts making the cheese. Some people use a mother culture, which as far as I understand, people like Graham Kirkham and Stitchelton and Habbard, some of the best cheeses. And this is a culture, as far as I understand, that has been taken from original farms and then is kept alive and bred down by a lab in, majority of it use a lab in Somerset. And then you used to, one said you were buying that back.
Yeah, so we used to use, that culture, MT36, and it was like the holy grail of artisan cheese, from my understanding. So when I was going around talking to cheesemakers about, so what cultures you're using, they fell into two types, you know, they were either using cultures, like DBIs, you know, the sachet type things from different producers, or they were using this MT36. So those traditional English cheeses like Cheddars and Lancashires and Cheshires and Cafillis, they were using some form of culture made by Barbers, who's the creamery who have their own starter lab. So I went in my early years to go and visit the chap in the starter lab there, and I said, so what is it? And he said exactly that. They were isolated strains from farms back in the day that this cheese company has kept alive, you know, by reculturing them, repropagating them, and they do a serious amount of work to keep those on track, to make sure that they're original and that they're in the same state. So over time, they don't evolve into something too far from what they began with. And that was, so we set out using those cultures. Well, originally we set out with DBIs. Then we made a shift.
Sorry to interrupt and to be stupid, but are they, like, so the DBIs, are they all the same? Like, would you have the same as, like, Graham Kirk and the same?
So.
Or would it be, like, if I'm making sheep's milk or I want to make a Lancashire, would they have a strain that sort of...
No, so, is it just... so MT36, which is just literally the product code, I guess, or the name, you know, that this lab is attached to it. Don't know what it stood for. Mesophilic, you know, whatever, or probably Mother Teresa 36, whatever you want, the lady of the farm, where they first isolated from. So this was one culture, and it's a pint starter, which means you buy it in a live form. So they're inoculating it into milk and then sending you it in this frozen culture, which you then inoculate on the farm with your own milk. So you pasteurise or you heat treat your own milk, and then you make with that, or some people actually use powdered milk to base the starter on. And you basically take this frozen milk culture and then you incubate it and then you get a live culture that you then use. The benefit of that over DBI is that it changes the acid profile, so that they get going a lot quicker. So they're straight to work as soon as you put them in a vat because they're a living culture. Yeah. Whereas your powdered sachet cultures actually have a lag phase where they have to first of all rehydrate, and then they have a time where they get to kind of, well, as it was explained to me, they get a feel for what's going on, and then they begin to reproduce and create acidity and, you know, other things that they're producing, background flavors through enzyme production. But this all goes on in the vat, and it takes a time. Whereas when you use these bulk cultures, you're adding this live component to it, and it just changes the way that process.
Now, I always understood that those bulk cultures produced potentially a better quality cheese because they weren't isolated single strains. They were a little bit evolving. They were kind of a little bit more diverse, and that's perhaps why.
Yeah. So the selection of what you could buy was different. So I know that the cheddar makers actually use single strain cultures.
Yeah.
But again, they use them from Barbers, so they're using these different strains rather than using a single strain culture from a packet from Christian Hansen or a commercial culture company. So the cheddar makers went down a single strain route because they were very their process traditionally was always very driven by a certain acidity schedule. Lancashire cheesemakers, Caerphilly makers, people making Wensleydale favoured, and even actually Colston Bassett Stilton, those makers weren't looking for this really rampant acidification. They're looking for a nice steady progressive acid curve, and with some of this potential for background flavours from these other things that are in there. So these multi-strain cultures, which is MT36 is the sort of queen of, you know?
Yeah.
So increasingly I was going around talking to people and they were all saying MT36, and it almost got to be a point of you just make me laugh because I'd say to people, oh, what culture is going to be like MT36?
You're in the
MT36 club. And I really liked it for a time. I was in the MT36 club and I thought it was really great. You know, we're all sharing notes and not winking at each other at MT36. And I thought that was great. And it was interesting because we'd all identified that we wanted something different from a DBI. And then we all wanted something different even then from maybe a single strain culture. So we wanted this more. With this nice progressive, this steadier acidification, this more unique flavours that are coming on in the background. And we'd all identify that. But strangely, somewhere in the mix, we'd all identify that we wanted to potentially create the same sort of character of flavour.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because we're all trying to make these radically different cheeses and we're all going to these efforts to make unique raw milk.
Yeah.
But then actually we're all tying it together by using the same.
You
know, it's like going, we all want to wear the same outfits.
Yeah.
You know? We all want to wear different outfits, but we all want to wear the same socks.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, That's fine, but why do we all want to wear the same socks? Well, because we all like this, you know. And you just go, well, is it because we like them, or is it because that's the type of socks that you
should
be able to wear? And it got to that sort of thing. I went with it, you know, because it was the best thing that we had to use with these old cultures, these MT36 to start. And then one season we had a bit of a problem with them, and they weren't working the way that I felt they should. And I think some of it was in the production process, the way we're making them. And I thought, we're going to do a lot of effort to try and make these cultures, and we're buying them. Yeah. And then they're not necessarily giving me the best results, but I don't know if there's any alternative. So I started to think about the idea of using our natural cultures. And in that time, I talked to people who were using whey for starter cultures.
Yeah.
We trialled using whey. But with St. James, it didn't work so well. So it works really well in lactic cheeses to use a whey starter, because you drive these very high levels of acidity.
Yeah.
And actually that protects, and you end up with these quite high concentrations of lactic acid bacteria, or very acidic, acid-tolerant bacteria, and they transfer. So you can recycle that whey day in, day out, you know, and you can use the previous day's whey. And it's a great way to make lactic cheeses, because you're just breeding ever more acid-tolerant bacteria over time. Yeah. So they suit that they suit the system. And then I talked to people making cooked, pressed cheeses, so like the Comté, Gruyère types, and they were working well with whey cultures. Something again, because of the cooking temperature. When you're raising the temperature, you're predominantly favouring thermophilic bacteria that are operating at that higher range.
When I went to visit Tiva, that's what they would do. They would take that whey, they would then heat it back up again, and the way that they kept it going overnight is they'd just put it in thermos.
Yeah.
Was it just like
just keep it alive?
Keep it, put it in the thermos, keep it warm, just put it on the side, and the next morning took it up the thermos, tipped it in.
So because you're just favouring these thermophiles, and that's what you're after. So the challenge for us was that we were neither of those processes. We were right slap bang in the middle.
Yeah.
So you started to talk to people, well, what about Lancashire cheese? And you come to this realization. A lot of them would start the process just by leaving the evening's meal warm.
Yeah.
They did that at Tiva as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
So some of them were just leaving it warm, and like Hollister, they just leave it overnight, you know. Yeah, and then the next morning they'd add that, and you'd use it in the Kirkhams. Their milk is matured at a certain temperature overnight, you know, and then that actually means they use very little starter culture the next day. So most of the influence is coming from the milk. But they're still adding to that MT36, some of this culture, you know. But I started thinking, well, what happens if you don't add the culture? Well, then you don't drive the acidity according to your schedule. So you can't take it out of the equation, because if you're just using fresh milk, which we do, we only use the morning's milk, then you can't do without starter culture, because you just don't get an increase in acidity when you need it. It will happen, but it's so delayed.
You
leave yourself, it's like an open goal.
And you need that to make the cheese, potentially to make the cheese safe as well.
Well, yeah, safety's a concern, but you know, ultimately the quality being the driver, you know, you just don't get the quality consistency by just leaving it to happen to itself.
Yeah.
And you start to think about, you know, everyone now is quite comfortable with this idea of sourdough.
Yeah.
And you think, well, that's effectively what we're doing. We're taking our own sourdough culture, you know, milk culture, and we're working on that. And then we're getting to use it, and then we're using that in the vat. So that's the essence. It took a bit of development, it took a bit of thinking about. But what we did is we went down the route, and we said, okay, that's fine. But what if there's a problem with that milk? Mm-hmm. You know, what's our safeguard against just fermenting up raw milk and then adding it to the vat the following day? And we thought, well, you know, as conscious, you know, we're trying to produce a product. Key fundamental, it has to be a safe product. You know, that's like a prerequisite. Otherwise, there's no point. You can be the best tasting cheese in the world, but if it's not safe, it's not good. So we decided we'd ferment various pots of milk and trials of milk from different sheep, different animals.
So you milked each sheep individually?
So we milked a group of sheep, about 6 or 8 different sheep, and we cultured up these pots, and then we sent them off for micro testing.
Yeah.
So we fermented them, we timed them, we set them in an incubator water bath at 22 degrees, and we popped them in, labelled them all up with the names and the ear tag numbers of the sheep, and then we watched for 18, 24, 36 hours as they formed into different gels. They form into different gels. It's the most fascinating experiment you can do, is take the milk from different animals and ferment it. And you go, well, is it for fun? What is it for? I don't know. I couldn't extrapolate any conclusion from them. I couldn't say they're young sheep, then you get the perfect thing, or they're old sheep. There is none of that. We just incubated, you know, all these pots. And over time, some will set into a nice, beautiful, thick set yogurt with not a single bit of gas or, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
And then some will be digested, and it starts to get like tough and twists, you know, as the curd sort of mats together inside it, so it forms a curd, and then it like twists a bit or separates out. Some of them shear into little sort of grain granular plots of milk, and it stays milk. and some of them do something else, and they all change, you know, bizarrely. All these different milks offer different potential.
Yeah.
And you, so you start going, okay,
different outcomes for your cheese.
Potentially every one of those could be another cheese, couldn't it? A different outcome. So I started thinking, well, this is interesting in itself, because this has suddenly opened the door that, to me, having been that cheese geek with the cheese catalogue, looking at cultures, I've done that. You know, I've got Coquard, is a great company in France, and they provide different cultures and geotrackers. And there's a list,
and it tells you
how they're going to be. And I was the cheese nerd, so I played around with that for a bit. I've been through this list of adjuncts and things, and I was like, this is great. Look, if I do that, it'll make it more nice. And so, as a cheese nerd, sat there with a table of pots, you know, going, well, which one do you want to play with now? You know, it was quite interesting. So we thought, send them all off for micro testing.
I would find that just a total minefield, like too much. It would be like, what do I do?
Well, I didn't do it the first day I made cheese, you know. I'd been making cheese for probably 7 or 8 years, something like that, you know, before I started to think this is just interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And we didn't immediately start away. First, we'd begun fermenting these little pots and cultures.
Yeah.
So then we started sending them off for micro testing, and it was amazing. You know, the results coming back, they're like, this is, you know, defined quality. There was nothing in there we need to be concerned about. You know, we've got these kind of clean bill of health, if you like, on all these different
pots.
For all the pots. So we found that some of
you were milking by hand, as well, so there's no equipment.
Yeah, so there's no equipment involved. The vessels are sterile pots that we milk straight into.
Because the most your bad stuff is mainly environmental. So if you're milking it by hand straight into a pot, Where's the cross contamination?
What I mean is that's just good, because then you've got all of these different options that you can put. Like, it wasn't like.
So we started to just smell them and taste them. And but the thing is, somebody said to me, well, why would you want to do that? And I remember this conversation way before we did it. And I said, well, and I was like, well, why wouldn't you? You know, it's like, as a cheesemaker, we're all trying to make the best, most interesting thing, or, you know, sort of trying to produce the best product from our raw milk.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you don't think that your raw milk is the best base for your own raw milk cheese, then, you know, what's wrong with your raw milk, or why are you bothering, you know? Why don't you just work entirely with somebody else's milk, you know? So you start thinking, if I want it to be on my raw milk, and I want to truly express that raw milk, then surely the starter cultures, which are so clearly
fundamental in cheese.
Well, you know, again, this little club that we're all in, the MT36 club, one thing I took as a consensus, we could all argue over cheese type, flavours, textures, you know, whatever. But the one thing we all agreed on was that picking the right starter had an influence on the final cheese.
Yeah.
So I thought, between my little group of consensus who agreed on nothing, we at least agreed that our starter culture was probably one of the most important things we could change in the cheese, was the starter culture.
So why don't you
So I thought, well, that's it. But it's funny how the consensus then, you know, it takes a little bit of time for people to take that and go, actually, if the most important thing you do is change your culture, why don't you grow your own cultures?
Yeah.
And it's opened a huge, you know, it's like a minefield, as you said. It's more, the minefield is more people's perceptions to it, you know? And,
people have been told for the last 50 years, they've got to add starter culture to make cheese.
Well,
but we were looking at my grandma's little book, and you looked at a book that didn't even mention, like, what was it, 1860?
Yeah.
She didn't even mention starter culture at all.
No.
You just make cheese. Or like when you go and visit the really traditional guys in the Alps, they're making meso bit of cheese like you, like acidified cheese, not the cooked curd ones. They don't bother about starter culture. They're just using wooden equipment.
Yeah,
so it's there.
Wooden tools. You
wooden
know,
tools. Yeah, it's there. The bacteria.
It's hard flavors. The funny thing is that you know, people, you know, cheese makers, I'm sure they look and they go, as you said right at the beginning, we already make a divisive cheese. You know?
Yeah.
My cheese hasn't become less divisive.
Yeah.
Since I've started using these cultures, it's always been a divisive cheese. You know, a strong wash rind sheep's cheese that we engineer to almost taste of the animals on the farm.
Yeah.
That hasn't got any weirder because we started using cultures.
No.
It's not become less divisive. In fact, actually, I talked to a friend of mine and I said, I think it got less weird.
Yeah.
Actually, when we started using our own cultures, there was less of that weirdness going on, because there was it just tastes of itself. It was like we'd refined it. When I first started, I felt as though we'd simply just refined the process. Like, there was just none of those other little flavours in the cheese that I didn't know where they were from. They just tasted of itself even more.
Because when you buy an MT36, yes, it's a good bacteria that you're buying to make cheese, but you're effectively buying somebody else's farm's bacteria.
Yeah, exactly.
It was cultivated 50 years ago, and it's been kept alive since then. But that's all you're doing, is buying somebody else's
weirdness
and problems and putting them in your own, you know?
Yeah, you're adding somebody else's weirdness to your weirdness.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas you've got with those. And no doubt, how did you? Because you told me you selected the one to use by flavour.
Yeah, so then we started. And the funny thing was seeing how your own attitudes, your own milk changes.
Yeah.
And so having been, you know, sterile, having been inoculated with a certain an understanding of raw milk cheese. And you know, we do a lot of micro testing. We're constantly looking. We're searching actively. Mm. We're actively searching for bacteria in our cheese, you know, and for the good and the bad ones, we're actively going out looking for it. So it's always this thing of like, we want to really, if we do anything a bit odd, we want to look at it first, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sort of presented with these pots of varying smells and flavors and qualities, and I'm thinking, you know, I just want to put a teaspoon in and taste it, and I'm thinking, whoa.
<You're scared.
laughs> Yeah, there's this little bit of the back of your mind going, but is that a good idea? They've not been tested yet. And then I started to come to this thing of, well, what am I looking for? Why would I expect to find it? I've spent the last 10 years producing cheese milk, or you know, producing cheese milk and looking for it and not finding these things. So why would I expect to find it in this milk at this stage? What, you know, we've been engineering our system to produce this safe, clean, quality raw milk, you know? So just because I've then decided to inoculate it without adding any cultures to it, shouldn't somehow mean that, you know, there's some sort of crazy contamination in there. This is just the milk we've been producing for 10 years,
yeah,
allowed to ferment on its own. And I was like, there shouldn't be anything in there, mm-hmm, because we're actively building the system around not having anything there.
Yeah.
So the idea you then let that milk ferment. It's not as crazy as it sounds, but it was quite unusual for me to be presented with that and have it so striking and clear,
mm-hmm,
that actually this is what you're doing anyway. You're just fermenting your own raw milk, you know?
Yeah.
That's what we've been doing all along.
Which and then you also, the, you create that product which is unique to your, like the only thing you add in now is salt and rennet.
Yeah, salt and rennet.
Because the bacteria you're using is like your farm, your culture. Even, it's like, I always think, you know, like you get vintages of wines every single day. I was trying to explain to somebody the other day, you almost want to sell St. James under a different name every day. Because most cheese mongers won't tolerate that amount of variability.
No.
But at the same time, it's an interesting thing, because it's like, well, it might even be different next season because you've picked a different pot.
So,
you know,
yeah,
or
so
even throughout the season.
I think it helps us sell the kind of cheese we do, because it's that talking point. It's what's interesting about it. Because you can say, oh, this cheese changes every batch. But to quite a lot of palates, maybe it doesn't, or like they're not quite sure what you mean by that. But when you present them with St. James and they come in the next week, there is differences.
Or even like there is times when we have two batches on the counter,
yeah,
and that's good.
So
yeah, because it's a talking point, and you're like, you come into a specialist cheesemonger, and
why
you
shouldn't we be able to have products like that?
Let's just taste this, and what do you think? Which one do you prefer? Oh well, yeah, I don't like that one either. I think that's why people come to shops like us and to work with products like yours. Yes, I want them to be consistent, because especially when it's good, I want it to always taste like that. But at the same time, you've got to kind of...
But we've said consistency of quality, not necessarily
consistency of quality, not consistency of flavour, which is different.
So I think we've had our palates a little bit standardised. And so I think makes this, like you said, these strange and unusual flavours, and
yeah,
it's so challenging for people because you're used to cheese tasting a certain way.
Mm.
Yeah.
You're used to going in the supermarket and picking up a mild cheddar and it tastes this way, and that's what you expect from it. Mm. And then you pick up a strong cheddar and it's like the mild cheddar, only stronger. But it's still got all the same pinch points and flavours and sensation on your tongue, but it's just that one's a bit more, you know. They even grade cheddar 1 to 5 strengths, you know, and
that's
done because that's basically what it is. We've told you, you've been told to do how cheese should taste, you know, by what you've been given. And as we're increasingly going down this industrial food culture, you're being given these options. And I think that people start to think, but equally, even some of the sort of artisan in its infancy, this artisan cheese industry in the UK, we've, you know, some of the artisan producers have been guilty of following that a little bit as well, you know, so they're actually aligning themselves with a sort of a more industrial food flavour system.
Yeah.
And they're aligning themselves with it because, guess what, it's popular, it's what customers come to expect. If you want a cheddar that tastes sweet and sharp because that's what you're buying in the supermarket, and then you decide you're going to get a slightly better, more upmarket cheddar and spend a bit more money, you know, it's not unsurprising that people first go and pick a sweet, sharp cheddar, just like the one they've already had, but with a bit more interest. So actually, we've sort of followed a route, or we're increasingly following a route of standardised palates and flavours. So then then for us, when we throw something out there and they go, God, it doesn't even taste like cheese.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what a strange idea, because it is cheese, you know? But how can it not taste like cheese? But suddenly you're going, well, it doesn't taste like the cheese that you've had before, or the cheese that you could buy somewhere else. It tastes just like our cheese, this specific regional, you know, even, you know, this isolated example of how you can make cheese on one farm. Mm. That's what it tastes like.
Yeah.
And the strange thing is the St. James changes all the time, and the flavour changes, but you can spot it a mile away.
you know,
it's St. James. If somebody gave you a taste of it anywhere in the world, you would go, bloody hell, I'm pretty sure that's St. James.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a character there that even with all this variation, people go, that's St. James. You know?
Yeah.
And that for us is like, that's something, you know, we can't brand the type of cheese and we can't label and we can't,
yeah.
You know, we can do that to a point, but we can't stop somebody copying it. We can't stop somebody imitating it. But if you can make something that's just of your farm, just about your little isolated method and production and style, then that's ours, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
and anybody's welcome to imitate what we do,
yeah.
But they're going to have to do it at the same cost, the same aggro, the same work, the same time and commitment. They're going to have to go through the same process that we have to come out with the same. And you know, if they do that, brilliant, because they'll have their customers by that time too. And we can compete side by side and say, look, we're both making products that are interesting,
yeah.
And they'll be totally different. So that's, you know, that's fine. It leaves room for everyone, I think. You know, we're not trying to grow to be this huge monster that owns the cheese market, you know. Or if we are, we're doing it really badly. But you know, we're leaving room that everyone could.
But that's what I mean. I always, we were talking about this with Graham actually, that I still think fundamentally you need more cheese shops like myself and Cat More Cheese and the other and Jordan, because the more of them, the more people like you can be talked about. Because your product is difficult to sell to most, even most farm shops and delis, let alone multiples, who then are going to have a problem with this change, this evolving cheese, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so you know, I've walked both sides of the line of retailing and production and retailing production my whole life. You know, my first job was with my father, where we're you know, cutting up pigs and doing the butchery and manufacturing sausages and then retailing them for a market, and then, you know, went into manufacturing Graham Kirkham and then retailing on markets and events with him, and then so I've always tread to even to the point where I set my own cheese shop, you know, and so I've always tread those lines. And one thing I do know, one thing I do know is that the consumer, you need the retailer to drive these trends. You know?
Yeah.
Consumers ask for a product and producers are willing to make it, but you can't tie the two together without independent retailers. So the key thing is these little cheese shops, the independent retailers, the guys who are saying, yeah, I'm going to stock something that everybody else has, and I'm prepared to stock something that's regionally different, or even have my own little versions, you know? But those guys, they can drive trends forward, you know. They can actually connect the producers to the customers, which actually, as a producer, it's very difficult to make that connection without the guys in the middle doing that work, you know.
Yeah.
So you're a key part of, or independent shops like this are a key part of that process, because there are people like me who want to do it, and there are customers who definitely are out there want to buy it.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing goes forward without the guy in the middle who puts them together.
Yeah. And I think from there, I always think that it's the same in restaurants. I think when you get a Michelin star restaurant, you see what they're doing. In 10 years' time, the high street doing it, or the other restaurants doing it. And I think that the good retailers, what we do, what we push forward, the best retailers, then filters down into the average and then eventually into the multiples, but it slowly improves.
It is like a catwalk.
Yeah, you are the catwalk of cheese culture, yeah. But no, I would agree with you. Yeah, this is a spotlight.
Yeah.
You're not saying everybody should eat cheese like this.
No.
You're not even saying that you will eat cheese like this all the time, 100% of the time, you know? But you're saying, look, this is an example of what can be achieved at this level. And you know, and people can take pointers from it, you know, and that moves, it advances things forward, you know, like, and it changes things.
I have eaten a lot of cheese in my life, and I eat a lot of cheese every day. And what I find is that the more cheese I eat, the more what the cheeses that I will take home become those that are made in the style of where you're taking it to the next level with your natural starter bacteria, but those ones that are going that way. The Ativas, the Yumbucks, the Stichtons, the Havers, the Kirkhams, and they're very different cheeses. But if I was to compile a cheese board, those are the ones, the more I eat cheese and the more I work in cheese, those are the ones that kind of
people are really thinking about how to make the most of what they've got.
Yeah, and get those building blocks together and make a really interesting cheese. But you know, they're very different styles of cheese. They're not all like yours, soft and pungent and smelling like Graham Kirkhams, a very approachable cheese. But you know, when I bring cheese home, there are all those people pushing those little boundaries of how you make cheese, you know, is a more reflection of your farm.
Yeah.
And you're kind of taking it to that next level. And you've got somebody, unfortunately, it always makes me laugh, this. Do you know Robin Betts, cheese maker down in Winterdale, Shaw makes cheddar down there?
No.
Completely eco-friendly, really cool guy. I met him, when we last met him, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, working for Fine Cheese. And he came to the Specialist Cheesemaker Association to do down in Totnes, and he came in his electric car. It was a day late because electric car went out of petrol. And I went out of battery and he had to sleep in it overnight. But you know, I really have a respect for him because his whole business is completely eco-friendly. Like his cellar, his cheese making is underneath his house. His house is on top of his cheese making room. You know, it's and he for him the driver is
that's amazing. Yeah.
But he got electric cars when they right at the pioneer. You need those pioneers. You need Robin Betts driving that electric car and stuck in a service station, sleeping in his car because we're not electric. And but we need that in terms of we need that with you in terms of cheese making. We need those people pushing the natural starters because. You know, 100 years ago, as we looked at my grandma's book, there was only how to make starter. There wasn't get packet or buy it from somebody else or buy a culture. It was like, this is how you have to make starter for your farm.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, we're doing it 100 years ago. We need to relearn that and we need somebody to push it forward.
Yeah. So we're not doing anything different, but we're trying to adopt these and bring them and bring it more into the mainstream. Yeah. And you're like, I sort of came to this conclusion that if I don't do it, who else is going to do it?
No.
You know, I'm making a point of trying to talk to people about exactly this kind of thing because. You know, there's some interesting conversations we had. There's some interesting cheeses we haven't yet eaten that are going to come from this movement. You know, it might be a movement. Yeah, you know, it might burn out. It might be something I keep to myself. And in 20 years' time, you'll be mourning the death of the last natural cheese maker. And that's fine. You know, 20 years. God,
20 years of cheese making.
This is all I've got.
But then, for me,
20 years of cheese making. But you know, I think that or it might be something that people adopt. You know, and in the same way. As bread now, you can't, you know, there's so many people making sourdough breads and sourdough loaves at home and the uptake of that sort of culture, natural wines are starting to become relevant. And again, there's lots of variations on it, you know, people even taking up, you know, even culturing up your own raw milk and using it as an adjunct alongside a commercial culture or incubating, or, you know, maybe even looking at the way you mature your evening's milk before you add it to your morning's milk in a cheese vat. These are all things that are going to, you know, that are adding stuff, or even maybe some of the lessons that I learned from doing what I do. That give me more interesting natural cultures.
Yeah,
might be transferable to, you know, other raw milk processes and parts of the process that people can go, actually, that's interesting. We can take that. So it's going out there and just going, you know, let's find out as much as we can. Yeah. Let's look at everything and then let's compare notes and talk about it and see. Let's make some cheese that's really inspiring and different because we don't need to make cheese that's bland and every day. There's thousands of cheesemakers, and in fact, the more there are, the less interest there is for people to make something the same. You know, it was almost when there was only 200 people in the UK making cheese, it would have been acceptable to make
an average cheese
because there's a market, you know. But as you get into like 1,000, 2,000, you know, as the number of cheesemakers grows, which it does every year for different reasons, you know, it's more important now, it's more essential now that we carve out our own niches. You know?
As a raw milk cheesemaking industry, I think this is personally, I think it's the course it has to naturally go down. Is to go more a reflection of your farm, and whether it doesn't, you can then alter the recipe, or whether whether you make a brie or a cheddar or a Lancashire. But the more people we can harvesting their own bacteria and making a cheese unique to their farm, the more they're making those unique products. Because the middle ground, the artisan cheese industry, which is not the raw milk cheese industry, is kind of getting very good at making bries and washed rinds and cheddars and Lancashires, which are good quality.
Now. Yeah.
The small farms like yourself. You can't compete financially even with the medium-sized artisan producers.
No.
You know, they're very good. You know, like you look at Yorkshire Blue, it's a lovely cheese. And you couldn't make a blue cheese that could compete financially on their level.
No, so we've got to make
it. So you've got to kind of go that next step. And I think this is a natural next step. You know, and I
this is driven, I mean, my change and my, you know, we've been 4 years now doing it.
Yeah.
And it was maybe five years doing it. And that was a change driven by me, partly as my passion for making an interesting cheese and seeing where we can take it.
Yeah.
And partly just, you know, economic reality. We're a small producer. We're always going to be a small producer on the fringe even, you know, of what's even economically viable. You know, we're a micro dairy. We're not a dairy or a small dairy. We're a micro dairy. You know?
Your husband and
wife. It's two of us and we've got a guy that helps out when he's not doing comedy gigs on weekends, you know. it doesn't get any smaller than that, you know. How are we going to compete? How are we going to make sure that our cheese is rubbing shoulders with the best and being in the right place? Well, yeah, by shouting about what we do and by making it more interesting, more characterful, you know, more honest and more authentic. So.
But what's really exciting this year is you've been doing a scholarship as well from the Nuffield to go and to increase this knowledge.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting thing for me. So I didn't do my A-levels and I didn't do any sort of university or formal education like that. So. I went to work for, like I said, family business originally as a butcher and then went to work for cheesemakers. So everything I've learned has been at a practical level. And I've done my best to keep up on cheesemaking courses where I can and do some and been involved in a very sort of broad learning sort of experience, which has been from, like I said, visiting other cheesemakers in the Alps or wherever.
Yeah.
And that's been good, but this is about writing a paper. So the Nuffield thing for me is about accumulating a lot of that knowledge and information, and finding and already identifying the gaps in what I know or what I want to know. I realised there was gaps there and things I couldn't back up, and hunches and gut feelings that I had that I want to go and see, actually, am I right or am I wrong, or how does this work, and look at the science that's out there. So I realised early on that I'm going to need to travel to places that I wouldn't be able to travel to,
to talk to people.
So bizarrely, in the world of international cheese, one of the most exciting places is the USA. Because they've come they've come from where we were in a little way. So back in the 70s, 60s, there was no cheese, sort of movement in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've grown, we've replaced, and to replace an industry takes a lot of sort of soul searching and real like digging deep, drilling down on information. So actually, if you go somewhere where they've got an established industry,
they're almost complacent.
I wouldn't say complacent, but the information's there, but it's not as, it's not valued in quite the same way. So I think that what's happened in the States is they're trying to revive an industry, and they've had so many people. Obviously, their home market for these products is huge, and they're a nation of immigrants, so they've got a really diverse mix of that. The USA cheese board is already a diverse mix.
Is it a bit like old world, new world wine in that sense? That like, well, they can kind
also
of,
like the breads as well. They've got so many different influences.
They haven't got
constraints.
They haven't got any constraints.
Yeah, maybe because they're not coming out. They've not had that history or that tradition. So they're coming out with a real blank canvas. Yeah. Like, let's make some really great cheese, and let's find out about it. And so if we want to make a Vacheron type cheese in Vermont or an aged Gouda up in Wisconsin, then we can do that. They can do that out there because there's no tradition holding them back. Yeah. There's no expectation, and also because the market they're selling into is quite sophisticated with this multicultural mix of big cities and big urban educated urban population. It's been a breeding ground, I would say, in my opinion. Plus, there's a few key players who've been really smart, and they've had a huge influence, and they've worked with universities and outreach programs to get some really intelligent work done on raw milk microbes and cheese rind communities and things like that, So these are things that fascinate me. So first and foremost is going to talk to the guys in the US.
Yeah.
Plus there's an obvious advantage that they all speak my language, so that's the first and foremost. There's a huge amount I want to learn there because it's right at the forefront of what we're finding out, I think.
Is there a particular area?
Vermont. So I'm going to go and spend some time with the guys in Jasper Hill in Vermont, which is a cheese maturing. And they're cutting edge, and they've got their own micro lab now on the farm, and they're compiling cheeses from different producers nearby. And I only know what I've read and seen and through talking to the guys there, so to go and see that firsthand and see what they're up to is going to be really good for me, something I want to do for a long time. And then the second stage is actually going right back. So they're sort of following a science route, talking to research institutions, talking to labs and universities where I can about what I want to find out about these indigenous bacteria and how the farming method or the farming model influences and affects what's available on the farm. So obviously if I'm making natural cultures from my own fermenting milk, the key thing is having the right mix and balance and populations of cultures in the farm in the first place. Because I can only work with what I've got.
Yep.
So once you decide you're going to work with what you've got, then obviously the end game is to improve what you've got, and so we'll look at the farming systems that enable a more interesting mix or even just a more diverse mix or something, or even a more unique mix, but just looking at the mix of bacteria and potential flavours and qualities on my farm. So these guys have been doing some research on exactly that, some places in the States, and the guys at Jasper Hill are big into this, and this is what they're getting involved in. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, he's going to look at where they've always done it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to really isolated communities, in the Alps, on islands, places where they haven't really changed much, and they haven't actually lost their cheese making culture and tradition.
Yeah.
So places where they're using wooden tools, places where they're using wooden vats.
But even and we talk about it being a concern in Britain. We're trying to go, but you're part of the forefront trying to learn this. Natural cheese making, should we say? But when I talk to them, our French counterparts, and I know a couple of good Italian counterparts, they're going backwards. They're losing.
Yeah.
So you need to get this information now.
So one of the key things is, where are the threats at? You know, so we can go, well, the threat is, you know, is simply changes in farming methods, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the biggest threat. So you've got to identify, well, why are people changing the farming methods? Well, one, if they're changing it because regulation, then you can blame the regulators. You know, if they're changing it because nobody wants to buy their products anymore, you can blame the marketplace. Or, you know, if they're changing it just simply because nobody knows about it and their products aren't marketed, then you can perhaps blame the retailers in that sense, you know. And if they're just changing it because they don't understand how valuable their own processes are, then of course you've got to lay that at the, you know, the sort of the door of the farmers and the cheese makers. But understanding where these threats are, so that when we, you know, if we eventually sort of come through this movement to say, well, how do we protect what we've got and how do we look after it?
Yeah.
Well, if we can see the mistakes already made and why they're losing these traditions, then it gives us a thing. So the classic one was wooden boards, you know, the wooden board fiasco got a lot of press in the cheese world because suddenly America woke up one morning and decided that they weren't going to let cheese into the USA.
They've been aged
on wooden boards, you know. Yeah. And for about 3 months, the whole world scratched its head and said, what on earth is going on?
Yeah.
And it took a change in regulations, changing back to allow, and it took a lot of work to get people to accept it. But something like wooden boards now has become almost accepted, that you can age cheese on wooden boards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, there was a time where that was under a certain amount of threat, you know. And it's that sort of that process of threat then actually tends to bring to the surface, like it bubbles up, and you get all that data and all the information that's out there suddenly gets translated into a different language and arrives at the surface and gets printed and published, and then you move through and you go, okay, that's good. So, but the same thing hasn't happened with these natural cultures yet.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the information is actually still on farms, or it's still with regional food groups or technicians.
It's still in most places going backwards. We're going away from natural cultures in most, on the continent particularly.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen enough yet to fully understand it. But I know there's a big nucleus already. So for them to lose, there's a lot they've got to lose.
Now is a time to kind of try and learn as much as possible. It's a key time and try and almost reverse that trend. You know, a friend of mine in Italy is. It's a big thing in the slow food at the moment over there, is to try and stop those producers from going down the easy route of buying a DBI and chucking it in. It does what it's supposed to do, because it's a hell of a lot easier way to make cheese.
Well, it's commercially driven as well. Yeah. You know, the culture companies, they want to sell culture.
Yeah.
You can't blame them. They're running a business. That's what they want to do, you know. So if they can influence that, and, you know, environmental health, the regulators, they want an easy life. So if they think that you can achieve it, but actually, you know, it's not necessarily a cure all, you know. DBI cultures aren't going to make these products safer.
No.
You know, like keeping keeping cheese on plastic boards
never
made it any safer. Yeah, you know, exactly. So I think it's like understanding this diversity. There are groups who are doing it really well and they're protecting it, and they've had their successes. You know, Reb Lachon with the wooden boards, great example.
Yeah.
Technician moved in, ate to producers, and they secured the use, and that was it. It was under threat for a period, and then the threat went away because they sold it. They did all the work. But that's an example of work for someone who's done it and come through the other side. But, you know, like you say, there'll be examples of certain communities who are being told, don't do that, or don't do that, or don't follow that route. And I think that, just learning is one of those things. You know, you can never learn too much. Can you? By going out there and talking to people, we find more out and bring it back home and share it, then it's
good.
That's enough, a good thing, though. That's what the Nuffield's about.
I think you should be proud of you doing it, really. I think you should, the more we can spread that knowledge.
It's a British thing. So it was a scholarship program for farmers and people that work in food and agriculture. It was set up in the 50s.
Yeah.
40s. That's old enough, I forget. By Lord Nuffield.
Uh-huh.
So Nuffield Foundation, and he basically said, look, farmers need to go away and learn best practice. So that was what it's about. It's about people going outside of their comfort zone and getting a travel sponsorship or scholarship.
Yeah.
But then come back, and there's a condition that when you go out and you learn new stuff, and you learn best practice, you come back, you write a paper, and you share it with other people, and you become a voice for that method of best practice.
But it's not just, it's across the industry, though.
Between 10 and 20 a year, something like that on average. But they award the scholarship to those people they feel can make the best use of it. So if they don't have the right people in, they won't award it. And likewise, if they have more people, they're not driven by it, they've got to tick a box. So, but what you find is it's around food and agriculture, and people who are looking to study something that they can bring back and advance their own industry. So for me, obviously, raw milk cheese making is a growing industry. You know, it's an exciting industry in the UK at the moment, and certainly raw milk in general is becoming very much a, you know, it's an exciting time for raw milk in the UK. So for me, maybe it was timely. It was certainly for me, I'd never even looked at the flying thing like that before in my life.
Yeah.
So I applied because I wanted some help funding this study, you know, and further to further study microbes in cheese making. So they've got a long-winded title, but it's the scope of the study for me is about indigenous bacteria on farms and how they make it through into the final cheese,
mm-hmm.
and how you can affect, you know, the final cheese quality by what's available on the farm or by your farming methods.
Mm-hmm.
So it's tying the two up. So obviously I want to go and see places and talk to people who are doing a really good job. I want to also see people that maybe do a bad job,
yeah.
you know, and look at different farming methods and say, right, I'd love to be able to come back and say, yeah, I can write you a, you know, route planner for when you're thinking about making raw milk cheese that says, you know, well, start with this and do that. And if you do that, you'll get these bacteria. If you do that, you'll get these flavours, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to be the case. Yeah, that's maybe
miracle worker.
Yeah, you know, but I think certainly adding some weight to the conversation, adding some
knowledge
into the debate, then I think that's got to be a good thing. I think it also, there's this question of diversity. It comes up all the time about farming in the UK, or farming actually, not the UK, farming the world over. Having real questions about diversity and going forward, you know, we're in a changing world with changing climate, and diversity may well be the thing that saves us down the line. So if you take diversity as being important in terms of animal species, you know,
mm-hmm.
not all keeping the same type of dairy cow,
yeah.
has a benefit to society, you know, a wider society maybe normally. Not all, you know, keeping the same type of chicken. Then you start going, well, beyond that, not all eating the same food, not all consuming the same bacteria, you know, not having all the same bacteria available on all the sort of farms. These are sort of fundamental questions, you know, that are going on in agriculture, this diversity of plant species, of
yeah.
You know, of wild birds and mammals, you know, that exist on farms, just diversity in itself. And I think that it will be easy to overlook bacterial diversity on farms. And to actually miss something there that's quite crucial, certainly in terms of, as you said, looking for flavours down the line of different products and, or how we market unique
yeah.
produce. The bacterial diversity, you know, from making hay on old-fashioned meadow pastures
yeah.
and how you can use that, those bacteria
yeah.
to influence better a flavour of cheese that yeah. then makes it more sellable.
Yeah.
You can't overlook that, you know, it's part of this, a changing farming system, you know,
yeah.
it's going to be something that could be valuable in the future. So I think that side of things makes it, you know, it's not just fancy raw milk cheese makers that
yeah.
I want to appeal to. I want to add something to the conversation about bacterial diversity on farms,
yeah.
and, you know, and how we can harness it, how we can alter them, use
yeah.
them, manipulate them, you know. Safeguard them, you know.
Well, I think it's the way farming has woken up. For many years we've gone around monocultures and in more conventional industrial style of farming, and I think that we're starting to wake up and see that the farm is an ecosystem, and the more it's about from the soil upwards, all the bacteria, all the plants and what you harness there creates a, what you want is a living farm, not something you have to chuck loads of stuff in.
The use of imports as we go forward, you know, resilience to climate change,
yeah.
you know, even economic resilience, you know, the ability to weather, you know, fluctuating commodity prices.
Yeah.
You know, these are all things that sort of farmers producing cheese on farm could have some impact on.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about what you were saying about going down the route of one species or one animal, you know, we're looking at a changing, evolving climate, you know, these are going to be things that are
tools,
but also the bio, you know, they're learning, you know, literally day in, day out, you're seeing new data, new research being done on, you know, the human gut,
yeah.
And how bacteria that you're eating are influenced, or that you're consuming, are surviving in your gut, are consuming are affecting your whole health, you know,
yeah.
the way you feel, the way you're, you know, the way your mood can be expressed, and some of this. Yeah, we're in the early stage of learning about the human gut and the biome and its impact on human health. And yeah, actually, we may have well lost half the species of bacteria we need for a healthy gut by changing our farming method. You know, I don't know if that's the case, but that's something that we have to consider, this diversity
yeah.
as being part and parcel of that. So if you can influence, you know, certain bacterial communities in cheese by what's going on through your farming process, and then that can influence human health through the effect on the biome, then that's got to be a study that's useful for everybody, I think. Yeah. So.
Thank you very much for coming along today. I think it's exciting times for you.
And the cheese is good.
And your farm. And this year, whatever you've harnessed this year in terms of your natural bacteria is good.
Yeah.
And I think that, yeah, it's hard. I think when you run a small business, nobody ever says so much, well done. But I think, well done, you're making good cheese and you're cutting edge. So thank you very much.
You're making nice cheese.
Nice cheese. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do that.
Yeah, that's brilliant.